Chapter 25. Selling the Agency. From the CIA's earliest days, the agency had a press spokesman whose job was to say no comment to virtually every question. The job was handled by an assistant to the director, who usually had other duties as well, such as coordinating training or arranging for the director's congressional testimony or speeches. It was pretty much a no-comment office, Walter N. Elder, executive assistant to Alan Dulles, John McCone, and Admiral William Rayburn, said. People badgered the agency, and most of the time the assistant had nothing to say. Walter Bedell Smith appointed the first person to the job in May 1951. He was Colonel Chester B. Hansen, a former public relations aide to General Omar Bradley. He was followed in October 1952 by Colonel Stanley Grogan, an Army public affairs specialist. Then came Joseph A. Goodwin, a former operations officer and Associated Press editor. Angus Thurmer, a former intelligence officer and AP correspondent. And Andrew T. Falkowitz, a career U.S. Information Agency officer. If these assistants had anything to say to the press, it was very specific, very circumscribed, and only on orders of the DCI. For example, when Francis Gary Powers was scheduled to testify before congressional committees about the U-2 incident, then CIA Director John McCone directed Grogan to call a dozen members of the press, from Ben Bradley of Newsweek to John Scali of ABC. Contrary to press reports, Grogan told them McCone would not be appearing before congressional committees that week to testify on the incident himself. He has notified the committees that are concerned, Grogan told the press, and they with him will set dates when he will appear before Congress. In addition to conveying such messages, CIA directors such as John McCone and Richard Helms talked with particular reporters or columnists who tended to be favorably disposed to the agency. Arthur Kroc and Scotty Reston, the New York Times columnists, were friends of McCone, Elder said. He talked with them on a background basis. But mostly, reporters who called the CIA for comment on allegations about the agency encountered silence on the other end of the line. The necessity of procuring good intelligence is apparent, George Washington said in a letter to one of his officers during the American Revolution, and need not be further urged. All that remains for me to add is that you keep the whole matter as secret as possible. With that in mind, the CIA, for most of its existence, has treated the American press as an adversary, a target that was to be manipulated at times, but never confided in or trusted. If the CIA thought it could use the press to its advantage, it did. Over the years, the agency put dozens of American journalists or foreign journalists working for American media on its payroll, tasking them to obtain secrets. The Church Committee and William Colby put an end to the practice, recognizing that to use the press for clandestine purposes impaired its credibility and hampered its effectiveness. When he became director, George Bush further tightened the restrictions. But as the Church Committee conducted its hearings and the media played up the abuses engaged in over the years by the CIA, the agency's disdain for the press intensified. The CIA had an Alice in Wonderland approach. If the agency were to deny a charge, the reasoning went, then the CIA's decision not to comment on other charges would be interpreted as meaning those charges were true. If other intelligence services knew that the CIA talked to the press, they would never deal with the agency. Sources and methods must be protected, the CIA said, refusing to acknowledge that there were shadings of secrets. That the fact that the CIA has a headquarters building in Langley could be considered a method, and that everything about the CIA is classified. Yet it was unrealistic and self-defeating for the agency to withdraw from American society. America was not like other countries where secrecy was often considered a virtue. America had been founded by men who considered the press to be an essential partner to government. They had won their freedom from the British Crown in part because of the ability of an unfettered press to publish tracts questioning established authority. The experiment had worked well. A free press stimulated the country's robust economy and competitive spirit. In the end, the CIA, like any other American institution, needed the support of the American people, who formed their views in part from what they read in the press. Other more established government agencies, such as the FBI, were more sophisticated at dealing with the press. They knew how to tell their stories, how to head off bad raps, and how to balance criticism without giving away all their secrets or appearing to sources to be untrustworthy. At any given moment, the FBI is pursuing thousands of criminal investigations, each one of which must be kept secret. The FBI, like the CIA, could pay someone to say no comment each time a question came up about its work. But the FBI realized there were ways to help the press around these sensitive areas, to deal with allegations without giving away everything the FBI does, ways the CIA had yet to understand. The CIA could be so good at influencing other governments, yet it seemed naive, almost obtuse, in dealing with the American press. It was one of the CIA's greatest failings. Often it was simply a disinclination to focus on the problem. I don't know if the CIA should explain itself better. I suppose it could, but I have to admit I don't know how it would go about that, said Richard M. Bissell, Jr., Deputy Director for Operations from 1958 to 1962. I don't think we could do a better PR job, not in a democratic society, said John McMahon, Deputy Director of Central Intelligence under William Casey. You have to live with the fact that when it screws up, it's going to get a lot of publicity, and when it does good, you're not going to see it. That's the life of an intelligence officer. If the people in the agency can't deal with that, they ought to be fuller brush salesmen. That's the nature of the work. William Colby understood the need to let the American public know what the CIA does. A public informed of the CIA's accomplishments and capabilities will support it, he wrote in his book Honorable Men. Yet even Colby, who helped bring the agency into the modern world, considered the duties of his press assistant primarily to be to keep the CIA informed about what was being said about the agency. Your comment is usually no comment, Colby told his press assistant. That bunker mentality began to change when Stansfield Turner became DCI on March 9, 1977. 2 months later, Turner appointed Herbert E. Hettu, a former career Navy public affairs officer, to open the CIA's first Office of Public Affairs. The idea was that the office would function more or less like the public affairs offices of other government agencies. Like the assistants who previously dealt with the press, the office also clipped articles so the CIA knew what the press was saying about the agency. Both Turner and Hettu believed that to the extent practical, an agency funded with tax dollars ought to let the public know what it is doing. They got a boost from Executive Order 12036, signed by President Carter on January 24, 1978, which authorized the Director of Central Intelligence to act in appropriate consultation with the departments and agencies as the intelligence community's principal spokesperson to Congress, the news media, and the public. The idea was heresy at the CIA, particularly in the Directorate of Operations, which looked upon Hettu as something approaching a traitor. I am not here to give away secrets, Hettu told operations officers in meetings. I am trying to be the lightning rod to make your jobs easier. But Hettu came away feeling he was hated by the clandestine service. At one staff meeting, an officer said, You are hurting us when potential agents read we have a PR office. They could get killed. Hettu wondered if they were right. During his tenure at the CIA, Hettu had come to be impressed by CIA employees. In his 25 years in the government, he had never encountered such honest, smart people. Hettu did not know anything about intelligence. He simply had a gut feeling that the CIA could be doing a better job in the press area. In the end, Hettu did not decide on his own what would be released. He attended staff meetings with the DCI, so he was fully informed on major issues. Then Turner and his deputies decided what to release. Almost immediately after taking the job, Hettu was faced with a controversy over the publication of Decent Interval by Frank Snepp. A former CIA officer, Snepp had written about his experiences in Vietnam without clearing the manuscript with the CIA, as required by his pre-employment agreement. The contracts state that anything CIA employees write must be cleared to make sure the material does not contain classified information. In the past, the clearance process had been handled haphazardly by the Office of Security and the General Counsel. Former employees were discouraged from writing books because they feared that the long process would gut their work. Indeed, over the years, the CIA had been engaged in the business of trying to suppress books rather than encouraging them. In 1964, for example, John A. Bross, then the CIA's comptroller, got the bound galley proofs of David Wise and Thomas B. Ross's book, The Invisible Government. The book was an expose of the CIA, FBI, and other agencies that had engaged in illegal activities. Ross obtained the galleys through a friend of a family member who was then working for Random House. With the authorization of John McCone, then DCI, the CIA asked Bennett Cerf, president of Random House, if the agency could buy up the first printing. Cerf responded that he would be delighted to sell the first printing to the CIA, but then immediately added that he would then order another printing for the public, and another, according to Wise's subsequent book, The American Police State. The agency dropped the idea. While the CIA would have liked to have brought legal action against the authors, they were journalists, not former employees. The CIA has gone to court only to enforce contracts signed by CIA employees when they enter and leave employment. The first test of this restriction came in 1974, when Knopf published The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence by Victor Marchetti and John D. Marks. Marchetti had been executive assistant to the deputy director of Central Intelligence. As a CIA employee, Marchetti had signed the pre-employment contract, giving the CIA a legal basis for moving against him. Acting on behalf of the CIA, the Justice Department first sued Marchetti to prevent him from publishing a magazine article about the agency. Then Marchetti and his publisher sued the CIA over the deletions the CIA insisted upon in the book. The CIA won in both cases, and the Supreme Court declined to hear the appeals. Eventually, Knopf published the book with 168 blank spaces to show where the CIA had required deletions. Over the years, the CIA approved new material for publication, filling in some of the blanks. The publisher included it in subsequent editions in different typefaces. By highlighting the secret nature of the material, the publisher made the book appear even more desirable. William Colby would later admit he should have taken the advice of John S. Warner, then the CIA's deputy general counsel, who said the CIA should demand deletion only of classified material that had not appeared publicly. As a negotiating ploy, Colby had ordered Warner to demand deletion of all the classified material. Later, Colby said the CIA could back down on many of the items that had already appeared publicly. The strategy backfired, and the book has continued to sell well ever since. Like Marchetti, Snepp had not cleared his book with the agency. Because Snepp had violated his employment agreement, the agency took him to court and won. Snepp had to turn over all his royalties to the government. On the other hand, when Philip Agee resigned from the CIA and wrote his 1975 book, Inside the Company, CIA Diary, there was nothing the CIA could do because the book was published overseas. With the Snepp experience fresh in his mind, Hettu decided the CIA needed a more systematic approach to clearing books. It was obvious employees such as Snepp would rather risk legal action by bypassing the clearance process than submit their manuscripts to possibly arbitrary censorship. Indeed, after looking over the Snepp book, the CIA decided only a few sentences would have been deleted if it had been submitted for review prior to publication. Hettu set up a publications review board within the Office of Public Affairs to review books and other manuscripts. With Hettu as its chairman, the board included a lawyer from the Office of General Counsel. The review board drew up strict standards. To show that material should be deleted, the board had to demonstrate that the item was classified. Even then, if the material had already appeared publicly, the board sometimes let it pass. But when William Casey became CIA director, the board stuck it to Stansfield Turner when he submitted his book for review. It demanded more than 100 deletions in Secrecy and Democracy, the CIA in Transition. Another area that needed improving was the agency's relations with the academic world. Like any large, technologically oriented company, the CIA needed a wide range of contacts with universities, both to recruit new employees and to sponsor research and obtain fresh insights. Recognizing that, William J. Donovan had persuaded President Roosevelt of the need for a coordinated intelligence service that would draw on the universities for experts with long foreign experience and specialized knowledge of the history, languages, and general conditions of various countries. Over the years, the CIA had sponsored classified and unclassified research, conferences, and special projects on everything from new security devices, technology transfer, terrorism, and the illicit arms market, to the future of Japan, human rights, population trends, and changing commodity markets. But any CIA contact with the academic world tends to be regarded with suspicion by some students and faculty members. Because of that reflex response, faculty members and universities involved in CIA projects often want to keep their involvement secret. That only exacerbates the problem. By CIA policy, a senior officer of a university must give his approval before a CIA contract can be awarded. When he was DCI, George Bush told the American Association of University Professors that the only ties the CIA sought with campuses were those made with the voluntary and witting cooperation of individuals who can help the foreign policy processes of the United States. Because of fear of protests, the university officer who knows of a CIA relationship, in many cases the president of the university, keeps the matter to himself. When it comes out, it appears that the CIA, rather than the university, was trying to hide something. For example, in June 1991, a major controversy erupted over the fact that M. Richard Rose, the president of the Rochester Institute of Technology, had taken a sabbatical to work for the CIA without informing the university where he would be working. The fact that the university had received contracts amounting to $5 million over 5 years then became an issue. Rose later admitted that he had made a mistake by failing to inform the trustees that he would be working at the CIA. He also admitted he should have let others at the university know of the CIA contracts. In the end, there was nothing wrong with the relationship, only that Rose had chosen to keep it secret. Still another kind of controversy erupted in the fall of 1990 at the University of Connecticut, where a CIA officer from the Foreign Resources Branch had asked for information on foreign students enrolled there. Under Executive Order 12333, which governs the agency's domestic activities, this was perfectly permissible. So long as the target is foreign, the CIA can obtain information on students and attempt to recruit them for later spying once they return to their countries. But by asking for lists of foreign students, the FR officer had used an unnecessarily intrusive and clumsy approach. It would have been far better for him to ask contacts he had developed for names of possible candidates for recruitment. To try to demonstrate that the CIA is not a boogeyman, Turner and Hetu began inviting presidents of universities to the CIA for all-day programs designed to acquaint them with the agency and what it does. Later, under Casey, the CIA started an officer-in-residence program, paying CIA officers, 11 at last count, to teach at universities for 2-year stints. In that way, the CIA hoped to show students that agency officers are human beings. Finally, under Turner and Hetu, the agency began selling maps and analytical studies to the public. Besides coordinating academic exchanges, clearing manuscripts, and responding to press inquiries, Hetu arranged during his 4-year tenure for hundreds of background briefings for reporters interested in particular issues being pursued by the agency's analysts. For example, a news magazine interested in the Soviet economy might obtain a briefing from CIA analysts working on the issue. It was never startling stuff, but reporters found the briefings helped to fill in gaps. By enhancing the CIA's credibility and building bridges to reporters, the practice helped the agency as well. By executive order, the CIA may not disseminate propaganda, whether true or false, in the U.S. If there is any possibility that information disseminated abroad might unintentionally wind up influencing the U.S., the activity must be approved by the DCI. But in the case of briefings to reporters, the source, the CIA, is known and openly acknowledged to reporters. The practice of giving briefings, therefore, does not violate any U.S. government policies. When Casey became DCI, he abruptly ordered Hetu to stop the briefings. Hetu wrote him a 1-page memo explaining that the practice helped the CIA's credibility with the media. "We have never been burned," Hetu wrote. The next morning, Casey asked Hetu, "Have you stopped the briefings?" "I wrote you a memo on it," Hetu replied. "I didn't ask you to debate it," Casey said. "I asked you to stop it. Now I'm ordering you to stop it. Stop it today. If you have any scheduled today, cancel them. Later that day, Casey called Hattu. You can let them come in if they will do some work for us overseas and report to us when they get back, Casey said. Hattu realized Casey was asking him to break the CIA's policies against using the press in operations, policies that went back even before the Church Committee hearings. It's against our policies. We're not allowed to task them, Hattu said. We would get nailed. Soon, Casey replaced Hattu with George V. Lauder, a former CIA operations officer. Ironically, Lauder reinstituted the briefings, but on a much more limited basis. With the stated objective of lowering the agency's profile, Casey on June 4, 1981, reorganized the Office of Public Affairs as a branch within a larger office. As in the agency's relations with Congress, the CIA's relations with the press quickly began to deteriorate. Stephen Engelberg had just begun covering the intelligence beat for the New York Times when he wrote a story saying Vitaly S. Yurchenko, the high-ranking KGB officer who had defected to the U.S. in August 1985, had identified several employees of the Central Intelligence Agency as Soviet agents. According to the September 27, 1985 story, it was not clear whether those reportedly involved were contract employees or full-fledged CIA officers. The night before the story ran, Engelberg called Lauder at home and read it to him over the phone. In journalism, one cannot be more fair than that. By reading the story to him, Engelberg had provided the agency with every opportunity to deny the story or to offer reasons why it should not run. Based on Lauder's response, the story that ran the next day said, George Lauder, a CIA spokesman, said he would have no comment on any defections or on suggestions that double agents had been discovered. Nevertheless, later that day, the CIA issued a statement denying the Times story. An agency spokeswoman, without identifying the defector, said only that a story in Friday's edition of the New York Times on CIA turncoats is untrue, United Press International reported. Engelberg felt he had been stabbed in the back. He had gone to the trouble of reading the story to Lauder before it ran, laying all his cards on the table. If Lauder had issued a denial then, the denial would have appeared in the story. If Lauder had questioned a particular fact, Engelberg would have had an opportunity to go back to his sources and question them further. As it was, the agency had lied. Yurchenko had identified Edward Lee Howard, a former CIA officer, as an agent for the KGB. Technically, the CIA could argue that Howard was a single employee and was no longer working for the agency. The Times, on the other hand, had referred to CIA employees, implying that there was more than one and that they were still employed by the CIA. But that was nitpicking and possibly not correct either. In addition to Howard, Yurchenko provided clues that are still being pursued about others who worked for the KGB. When Engelberg's story appeared, they may still have been detailed to the CIA, or may still have been working for the agency as contract employees. Thus, the thrust of Engelberg's story was correct. The CIA had publicly called into question the accuracy of his work after he had taken unusual pains to make sure it was accurate. Understandably, Engelberg was furious. He called Lauder and ripped into him. This is dirty pool, he told him. You had your shot last night, you waited until the story appeared, and now you issue your statement. You're calling me a liar in public, and I resent it. My absolute bottom line was we weren't going to tell anybody any lies, Lauder would later say. To the best of my knowledge, we never did. But he said he has no recollection of the details of the story. After that experience, Engelberg operated differently. He wrote a subsequent story saying that Yurchenko had identified a former National Security Agency employee as working for the Soviets. At the time, the FBI was keeping the former employee, Ronald W. Pelton, under constant surveillance while the Bureau tried to develop more information on him. The Times story could have warned Pelton that he was under suspicion, prompting him to try to hide his tracks or try to flee. So far as anyone at the FBI knows, Pelton did not learn about the story. But this time, Engelberg was not going to give the CIA the opportunity to pass on his story. He simply ran it without calling Lauder for comment. If the CIA had approached Engelberg to hold off on the story, the reporter would most likely have told the agency to bug off. At that point, I was so angry at George Lauder and the CIA that it would have taken a lot for me to hold anything back, Engelberg would later say. I was not going to call George Lauder and say, George, this is what I got, Engelberg said. He had lost that right. When William Webster became Director of Central Intelligence, those kinds of encounters became a thing of the past. Besides the President, Webster saw the press and Congress as his two most important constituencies. As Webster would often state, it was all part of keeping the agency accountable and remembering that it was there to serve the American people. He had learned a few things about handling the press from the FBI, which was highly sophisticated at feeding reporters just enough to keep them happy without blowing cases. Webster wanted a change in the way the CIA dealt with the press, and he gave considerable thought to whom he should appoint as his Director of Public Affairs. The PR person is one of the most important choices you make over time because you can't see the press as much as you'd like to, Webster explained later in his office at the CIA. They, the press, figure that if the PR person is trustworthy and helpful and honest, that must be the kind of person I, as director, want. If they are not, they figure I, the director, put them there. I didn't think I could find anyone in this organization, given their training, who could be open with the press, Webster said. For that reason, he chose as his first Director of Public Affairs William M. Baker, who was Assistant FBI Director for Public and Congressional Affairs when Webster was at the Bureau. Baker, then 47, had movie star good looks, with a tanned, youthful-looking face and innocent-looking blue eyes. He had remarkable antennae that could sense exactly what people wanted before they expressed it, and he had a direct approach that made people want to cooperate with him. Baker's appointment generated the usual false reports about Webster's motives in choosing him. According to these rumors, the two were close friends who played tennis together. In fact, Baker had first come to Webster's attention when Baker was in charge of a unit in the FBI's personnel office that deals with transfers. Baker had denied a request by a female agent for a transfer from one FBI office to another. Her husband had been transferred by his work, and she wanted to move with him to the new location. Both offices were within commuting distance, so the agent would not have been greatly inconvenienced in either case. Webster asked Baker to reconsider, saying it was a hardship case. Baker held his ground, and Webster called him to his office. Baker outlined his reasons. He said 27 other agents had previously asked to transfer to the same office, and it would not be fair to them to put the female agent ahead of them. "We have to have fairness in our transfer policy," Baker said. "If a female is involved because of her husband's occupation, certainly we should consider that. But there are agents with more seniority who wanted the same office, and in my opinion, some have a tougher hardship." Webster agreed with Baker and denied the transfer. If a subordinate could defend a position with a good factual argument, Webster would go with it. Later, Baker was in charge of the FBI's Portland, Oregon field office in 1983 when a Northwest Airlines jet was skyjacked. Webster was impressed by Baker's cool demeanor and forthright answers when he was interviewed about the crime on the evening news. Based on several recommendations, Webster appointed Baker to take charge of the FBI's public relations in 1984. In that job, Baker got to travel with Webster when he gave speeches, and he became one of Webster's most trusted advisors. One of Baker's friends said he must have gotten the job because he played tennis and had gone to a good college, the University of Virginia. The truth was the opposite. Not only had Baker never played tennis with Webster, Baker made sure he never did. Webster had heard that Baker played, and before one of their out-of-town trips, he asked him to bring along his tennis racket. Baker said he no longer played. Baker did not want to be known as a crony who had gotten his job because of friendship. He would help find other tennis partners for Webster during their trips. But when Webster was playing tennis, Baker took advantage of the time off to relax and jog. Baker also avoided visiting Webster's farm near St. Louis. One of Webster's St. Louis friends had told him the farm was as rough as a cob, and Baker vowed he would never go there. People who did not know the true reason thought he never visited the farm because he was afraid of horses. They were not far from the truth, since he detested horses. When Webster asked Baker to take charge of public affairs at the CIA, Webster asked Baker if he wanted to be detailed from the FBI. After they discussed it, they agreed that would send the wrong message, so Baker resigned from the FBI and joined the CIA. Like everyone else, Baker had to undergo a polygraph examination and a background check by the CIA's Office of Security. One day, Baker's wife, Robin, was taking their trash to the incinerator in their apartment complex in Maryland. A man identified himself as being from the Defense Department. In fact, he was from the CIA's Office of Security. "Do you know Bill Baker?" the man asked her. "He is my husband," she said. Flustered, the man explained that he was supposed to do a background check on Baker. He quickly retreated. When Baker took over the CIA's public affairs in June 1987, he found that much of the good work Herb Hettoo had accomplished under Turner had been torpedoed by Casey. Baker had to begin the job all over again of explaining to the agency why it was important to let the public know in a general way what the CIA was doing. Claire George, then Deputy Director for Operations, agreed to let Baker talk to each of his division and branch chiefs and later to all of the operations employees at headquarters in separate groups. In the talks, Baker would explain his own background. He would point out that, including a stint with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, he had dealt with classified material for over 2 decades. He understood the need to keep secrets. Then he would get their attention. "Why is it," he would ask, "that when you people are dispatched all over the world, you deal with the foreign press, distill intelligence, send back your observations, and then when you are posted back to this country, you seem to want to refuse to recognize the 2 entities that probably have more impact on the agency's future than anything else, the Congress and the press? Both were around before the agency began, and both will be around a long time after the agency is gone." Baker would tell the operations people he could do the agency some good. In some cases, he said, he could let operations people know of forthcoming stories so they could withdraw agents who might be in danger. "There is a lot you do that we can talk about," Baker would say. "The image that many Americans have of you, particularly after Iran-Contra, is not positive. There are ways we can work on that and improve public opinion and still be credible." Baker came to be impressed by the CIA and the dedication and competence of its employees. Yet smart as they were, they seemed to have difficulty understanding why so many people had a negative impression of what they do. Over the years, public views of the Central Intelligence Agency and its role in American foreign policy have been shaped primarily by movies, television, novels, newspapers, books by journalists, headlines growing out of congressional inquiries, exposés by former intelligence officers, and essays by experts who have never served in American intelligence or have served and still not understood its role, Robert Gates has said. While the CIA sometimes is able to refute publicly allegations and criticism, usually it must remain silent. The result is a contradictory mélange of images of the CIA and very little understanding of its real role in American government. If possible, most CIA people would like to keep it that way. Early on, one high-ranking operations official told Baker the ideal CIA spokesman always said no comment, never volunteered anything, and minded his or her own business. Then some of those same people wondered why the public had such a negative impression of them. In effect, Baker was there to market the agency, to let the public know that it does do good things. He had found in private surveys that the more people knew about the CIA, the more they trusted it. To be sure, the CIA's mission was not like the FBI's. At the Bureau, Baker could take advantage of a window, often when an indictment was announced, to trumpet the FBI's success. At the CIA, the greatest successes were the ones that the agency never wanted anyone to know about. But there were still ways to work things to everyone's mutual benefit. Baker would disarm reporters by asking if he could talk with them on a background basis, then engage them in give-and-take discussions. After all, the CIA was not like the Labor Department. Every responsible journalist realized that with the job of writing about the CIA went certain self-imposed restrictions. Most would not want to jeopardize a current operation if it did not entail an abuse. Nor would most blow the cover of a CIA officer unless he or she had been involved in wrongdoing that had larger implications for the agency or country as a whole. Since the passage of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982, which makes disclosing identities of covert agents a crime, journalists had to tread carefully in that arena in any case. Can you still have your integrity and still have your story and not say that? Baker would ask. Sometimes the answer was yes, sometimes no. Baker was doing damage control, and he was effective at it. For example, a year after Baker took over, Jeff Girth of the New York Times picked up a story that led to the disclosure that Clyde L. Conrad, a retired Army sergeant, was being investigated for transmitting classified documents to the Hungarian intelligence service. At the time, American and West German intelligence agencies were still pursuing sensitive leads in an effort to nail him. When Girth called Baker about the story, Baker told him that running the story then could well mean that it would be blown. The Times did not believe that the public's right to know necessarily included publishing stories that would jeopardize legitimate espionage investigations. It all depended on the facts and the timing. Baker did not actually ask Girth to hold off on the story, but he let Girth know that he would help him with the story if he could hold off. Girth knew from having dealt with him at the FBI that Baker could be trusted. When he said the case could be blown, Girth believed him. This was a different shop from the one run by William Casey, who had approached news organizations asking them not to print stories about what former NSA employee Ronald Pelton had told the Soviets, even though the Soviets already knew all about it, and Pelton had already been arrested for espionage. Girth agreed to hold off on the story. What Baker did not know was that at the time Girth did not have enough to go on anyway. The person who had tipped him to the story was not in the government. He had mentioned the report offhandedly at lunch. The man did not know the name of the suspect, and, as it turned out later, he had told Girth the wrong country involved in the espionage operation. But Girth could most likely have pieced the story together. Helped by Baker's tips, Girth unearthed the correct facts. 3 months later, Girth scooped the rest of the media with one of the biggest spy cases in U.S. history. For nearly a decade, Conrad had copied and transmitted classified documents about U.S. missile bases and facilities and NATO's fuel system for resupplying tanks to two Hungarian couriers. For the secrets, the Hungarian intelligence service paid Conrad $1 million. Girth's story led the August 26, 1988 editions of the New York Times. Conrad was later convicted of espionage. In June 1990, he was sentenced in Germany to life in prison. Baker had performed a service by making sure the story did not appear at a point when the investigation might have been damaged. Girth, in turn, had gotten a better story than he otherwise would have. It was a symbiotic relationship that would have boggled the minds of most of the earlier CIA spokesmen. Baker would deal with any reporter so long as the reporter was a professional and demonstrated that he or she would be fair. Like an advertising executive, he would refer to the Times account or the Post account. These and other major accounts he handled himself, delegating lesser lights in the journalistic world to his assistants. If a reporter was interested in a subject that the CIA could be helpful on, say Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika or restructuring plan, Baker arranged a briefing by the CIA's analysts. The CIA gave 122 briefings to the press in 1988. Compared with 32 in 1986, the year before Baker took over. By earning the trust of reporters, Baker could do a better job of alerting Webster and other CIA officials to impending stories so they could prepare for them. If a story was untrue, Baker either issued a no comment or expanded on the matter on a background or not-for-attribution basis. In addition, Baker might suggest that the reporter talk to another source to get more information, such as the Association of Former Intelligence Officers. In turn, Baker kept AFIO abreast of important issues without revealing classified information. David Atlee Phillips, a former chief of the CIA's Latin America and Caribbean operations, and six former colleagues, founded AFIO in 1975 to help explain the importance and meaning of intelligence to the American people. There wasn't a magazine or newspaper in the country or radio or TV that wasn't peeing from a great height on the CIA and the intelligence community as a whole, Samuel Halpern, one of AFIO's founders, said in explaining its purpose. Based in McLean, Virginia, AFIO has about 3,300 members from the entire intelligence community. About 10% are associate members who are interested in intelligence but not former intelligence agency employees. Besides answering questions from the press, AFIO sponsors luncheon addresses by intelligence officials and holds an annual meeting that features panels by people from the intelligence community. During one four-month period in 1990, David D. Whipple, the retired CIA operations officer who is AFIO's executive director, calculated that he did 96 press interviews, either in person or on the phone, on such subjects as the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and allegations that the CIA assassinated Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. There are a number of other associations of retired intelligence officers, and all of them exchange information through an informal organization known only as the Common Interest Network Luncheon. Representatives meet periodically at the Army-Navy Country Club in Arlington, Virginia. But while their agenda is to boost intelligence, organizations such as AFIO are not funded or controlled by the CIA or any other intelligence agency. By CIA policy, the agency may not fund or own an organization within the U.S. unless the organization discloses that it is funded by the U.S. government. Webster took the attitude that when an allegation is so outrageous or controversial that it hurts the reputation of the agency, or accuses the agency of wrongdoing where there was none, Baker should respond. Over the years, thousands of stories had appeared charging the CIA with everything from murder to drug running. In the CIA's early days, the agency had engaged in abuses ranging from illegal wiretapping to breaking and entering. It was exposure by the press, more than anything else, that led to the Church Committee hearings and the subsequent reforms. Occasionally, CIA officers learned about abuses from the press and took action as a result. For example, in his book, Colby recounted that he had first learned that the CIA might have attempted assassinations from a Jack Anderson column of a few years past making some allegations about a plot against Fidel Castro. After finding out that there was some basis for the Anderson story, Colby, as the CIA's deputy director for operations, got Richard Helms, then the DCI, to sign a directive prohibiting the CIA from engaging in, stimulating, or supporting assassinations. But because of the CIA's earlier record, its refusal to confirm or deny stories, and some overactive imaginations, the stories continued even when the agency had reformed itself. Some reporters, as well as some underground publications, created cottage industries churning out stories of CIA treachery. Usually the stories started with a few grains of truth, grains that could easily be planted to grow tales of high intrigue. For example, on a lonely stretch of road 90 miles from Sydney, Australia, two police officers came across a Mercedes with its parking lights on at 4 a.m. on January 27, 1980. Inside was a grisly sight. Under the steering wheel slumped the body of a man swimming in a pool of blood, a rifle in his hands. They searched the man's pockets and found the business card of William Colby, the former director of U.S. intelligence. On the back of the card was the itinerary of a trip Colby planned to take to Asia the next month. On the seat was a Bible with a meat pie wrapper between the pages. On the wrapper were the names of Colby and U.S. Representative Bob Wilson of California, then the ranking Republican on the House Armed Services Committee. The body was quickly identified as that of Francis J. Nugan, a co-founder of the Nugan Hand Bank, a merchant banking firm with offices in 24 countries. Within hours, telephones began ringing in the homes and offices of a spooky cast of characters who were some of the bank's directors, employees, or consultants. Three-star U.S. General Leroy G. Maynor, who had recently retired as chief of staff for all U.S. forces in Asia and the Pacific and who was still on secret duty for the Air Force. General Edwin F. Black, who had worked for the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the CIA, and had been chief administrative aide to Allen Dulles. Walter McDonald, a career CIA employee since 1975 and former deputy director in charge of economic research at the agency. Robert Red Jansen, a former CIA station chief in Bangkok. And Rear Admiral Earl Buddy Yates, whose CIA work went back to the U-2 spy mission over Russia, and who had recently retired as chief of strategic planning for U.S. forces in Asia and the Pacific. The bank's apparent intelligence connections, together with the suspicious circumstances of Francis Nugan's death, quickly led to allegations that the CIA had been using the bank to help topple Australia's Labor government, that the bank had been engaged in drug running for the CIA, and that the bank was a CIA front. As it turned out, the Nugenhand Bank was engaged in plots of a different sort. It was a pyramid scheme that bilked thousands of investors of their money. As frontmen, the founders, Nugen and Michael J. Hand, a highly decorated Green Beret, had enlisted a number of unwitting former intelligence officers to lend respectability to the bank's board. Hand, in turn, got Colby involved as a lawyer for the bank. When the scheme began to unravel, Nugen took his own life, leading to investigations all over the world. What the investigations uncovered was that the CIA had used the Nugenhand Bank for money laundering, a perfectly legitimate CIA activity that the CIA engages in to conceal its covert operations. The CIA uses a number of banks worldwide for the purpose. "You have to launder your money someplace," a former CIA operations officer said dryly. According to a former staff member involved in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's investigation of the CIA's use of the bank, they, the Nugenhand Bank, performed certain services. If you want to move a little money around or get some checks certified, you go to a bank to do it. Nugenhand had a reputation for being very aggressive. They would take your money and wouldn't ask any questions. What they, the CIA, was taking advantage of was a bank whose employees were willing to extend the full range of services, no questions asked. It was for laundering and concealing money. The fact that the CIA uses a bank for its transactions does not mean that it is a CIA front. Nor did any of the front men know that the CIA was a customer of the bank. In the same way, the CIA used the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the notorious international bank that regulators closed down in July 1991, to move money for the agency's clandestine operations. At the same time, as far back as 1986, the CIA began to report to other government agencies on the bank's criminal activities and secret control of First American Bank of Washington, reports that were ignored. Because the CIA decided the bank was dirty, it had closed all its accounts with BCCI by 1989. The claim that the CIA engages in drug running as a way of generating income goes back to the Vietnam days, when some individual operatives, working with or for the CIA, sold and transported drugs. But that did not mean the agency itself engaged in drug running. The allegation that the CIA engages as a matter of policy in drug smuggling is absolute nonsense, Herbert Saunders, a former CIA officer, said. This is not to say that a Laotian kicker employed to kick supplies out of airplanes working for Air America, a CIA proprietary, during the Vietnam era, wasn't peddling. There may have been bush pilots as well. But we didn't brand Eastern Airlines a professional drug smuggler every time a passenger or crew member was caught with some drugs in Miami. It's possible a CIA staffer went wrong along the way as well. It happens occasionally to the police and DEA. The Christic Institute, meanwhile, generated a stream of donations by undertaking litigation claiming that former CIA officers who called themselves the Enterprise had for years operated an assortment of nefarious plots that the CIA could not itself undertake, including a guns-for-drugs scheme to aid the Nicaraguan rebels. The Institute is a non-profit liberal public interest organization. As usual, there was a grain of truth to the allegation. The Enterprise did exist. It was the self-financed clandestine operation developed by White House aide Oliver L. North during the Iran-Contra affair. Using its own airplanes, pilots, operatives, airfields, and Swiss bank accounts, the Enterprise helped funnel arms to the Nicaraguan rebels. North called the operation Project Democracy. Richard V. Secord, a retired Air Force Major General who was one of the participants, and his partner Albert Hakim, dubbed it the Enterprise. But there is no evidence that such an operation began before North came on the scene. U.S. District Court Judge Lawrence King in Miami threw out the Christic lawsuit in February 1989, saying the lawsuit filed on behalf of journalists Tony Avergan and Martha Honey was based on unsubstantiated rumor and speculation from unidentified sources with no first-hand knowledge. The judge ordered the Institute to pay the defendants, including Secord and Hakim, $955,000 in legal fees, plus $79,500 in court costs. Another well-publicized myth was that the KGB assassinated John A. Paisley, a former officer in the Directorate of Intelligence, and that his body was never found. The fact is, the FBI matched Paisley's fingerprints with those on a body found floating in the Chesapeake Bay on September 25, 1978. But that did not prevent some journalists from weaving fantastic tales about the case. Those who knew Paisley said he was depressed about financial problems and undoubtedly committed suicide. Often, conspiracy theories are generated by disgruntled former CIA employees, by people who claim to have been employees but never were, or by people who are literally crazy. At any time, U.S. District Court in Washington has a handful of lawsuits pending against the CIA by people who claim the CIA has bugged their teeth or is following them. Journalists tend to form an unfavorable impression of CIA operatives because they never meet real CIA officers. Generally, the people they meet had only tangential involvement with the agency as contract employees. In some cases, they are pathological liars and never worked for the agency at all. Sometimes the stories on their face don't make sense. The Houston Post ran a series in 1990 claiming a possible link between the CIA and organized crime in the failure of at least 22 thrifts, including 16 in Texas. The rest of the press dismissed the Houston stories because they lacked documentation and were so murky that it was difficult to understand what they were saying. After an investigation, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence concluded that the CIA had briefly used the services of four of the institutions mentioned by the newspaper, but those relationships were consistent with routine agency financial practices. Other stories are so lacking in credibility that one wonders why any paper would run them. For example, an unemployed oil equipment salesman held a press conference in Dallas in August 1990 to say his father, Roscoe White, joined the Dallas Police Department on orders of the CIA so he could shoot John F. Kennedy. His son, Ricky White, said he based this on his father's diary, which disappeared after he told the FBI the story in 1988. If they can show any tangential connection to the CIA, accused criminals often use the CIA defense to try to get off. When Ronald Riewald was accused of bilking investors out of millions of dollars through a pyramid scheme in Honolulu, he claimed he was only following CIA instructions. In fact, the CIA admitted that it had used the firm as a drop for mail and phone calls. Riewald was convicted and is serving time. But stories persist that the CIA was more involved in the Riewald scheme than it admitted. Finally, the fact that the CIA has done something right is sometimes turned around to show that it has done something wrong. For example, Mark Hosenball, a producer with NBC TV's Exposé, claimed in the Outlook section of the Washington Post that the CIA had launched a public relations campaign to put its own spin on the scandal involving the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Through a campaign of hints, leaks, and unusual public pronouncements, the agency appears to be trying to keep ahead of the scandal by admitting a certain range of knowledge and involvement in BCCI, according to the article, headlined "The CIA's BCCI Laundry." The agency's tactic has been to admit that it was aware of the bank's involvement with criminals and that it used the bank to move money around the world. But the agency has insisted that its own involvement with the bank was entirely legal, the article said. Thus, by acknowledging that it warned other government agencies as early as 1986 that BCCI was crooked, the CIA was engaging in some kind of cover-up of its involvement with the bank, or so Hosenball seemed to be saying. When the agency declines to comment, it gets criticized, and when it comments, it gets criticized for commenting. The Outlook article went on to assert that the CIA did not provide enough support to back up its early warnings to the U.S. government's law enforcement agencies that the bank was crooked, as if the CIA's job was to regulate banks and prosecute criminals rather than to gather intelligence overseas. In what sounds like a Harvard Lampoon satire on media treatment of the CIA, the article said of one CIA warning about BCCI, "In reality, apart from references to unorthodox and unconventional practices, money laundering, and narco-finance, the five-page document is matter-of-fact in tone and hardly a call to action for American law enforcement agencies." Over the years, the CIA has learned to take it, just as CIA officers have learned to lie as part of their cover. It's no fun to see things in the papers that are not right, retired CIA officer David Whipple said. But the policy has been take it on the chin. If you are criticized for something unfairly, shut up, take it. Part of the penalty for being in the intelligence service is to take the fall. We're the scapegoats. This is something others in the Foreign Service applaud us for. We often take the blame when we are not responsible. We don't comment on our successes or our failures. When failures are ascribed to us unfairly, we don't comment on that. When we succeed, we never take credit lest we give away how we accomplished the success. Even those who know from the inside that the modern CIA does not engage in illegal activities sometimes find it hard to keep from believing some of the stories. I am amazed that sometimes I fall into the trap myself, said Russell Brumer, Webster's former general counsel, who is now a partner with Wilmer, Cutler & Pickering in Washington. I know mistakes get made, and I read things I don't know about, and I say, my God, how could they have done this? Then I catch myself and say, there must be another side to this. To be sure, the CIA has had its share of rogues. Edwin Wilson, an officer assigned to special operations within the Directorate of Operations, is a prime example. After leaving the CIA, he became involved in smuggling weapons and explosives to Libya. He was then convicted of plotting to murder the government prosecutors who had brought a case against him. Wilson is serving a 26-year prison term. But for all the aberrations, CIA officers tend to be at least as law-abiding as any other citizens. Baker, who came from an agency that had traditionally been rivals with the CIA, came to be impressed by its employees. Because their mission was not as well defined as the FBI's, they sometimes got themselves into more difficulties. But the CIA was not doing crazy things. It was performing a vital mission. Webster took the allegations personally. If the CIA was covering up or engaging in illegalities, then that meant he was, and he could not stand the thought. Overall, he admired the press, but some reporters simply were not fair. He particularly resented the items about the agency that appeared in news magazine gossip columns. It seemed to him that by and large they were pure fiction. It was Webster's policy to try to deal with the unfair stories head-on, to issue denials where possible, and in other cases to present the facts on a background basis. Only once did a CIA official ask Baker to issue a denial that was deceptive. Baker refused, explaining that the effectiveness of the press office depended on his maintaining his credibility. Early on, Webster asked for a check of CIA indexes to see if the agency had any record of dealings with a Greek banker said by some press stories to be a CIA agent. Based on that negative response, Baker issued a denial that the man had ever been a CIA agent. But later, another index was checked, and Webster found out that the man did show up in CIA files, not as an agent, but as someone who had had covert dealings with the agency. Webster was furious. Even though the denial was technically accurate, he did not want ever to be in the position of making a public statement and then having to retract it because he had not been apprised of the facts. "I don't understand how this could happen," he said. Both Webster and Baker were used to the FBI's system, where matters as disparate as a letter from the director to an investigation into drug dealing all appeared in the FBI's files under an individual's name. Because of the need to compartment information, the CIA has many indexes. Webster issued orders to engage in more extensive checking before such statements were made in the future. He wanted to be right the first time. As Baker would later crack, "I want to have full information so that when I say no comment, I can say it with authority." Ironically, while Casey tightened access to the CIA through his press office and fulminated about supposed leaks by congressional committees, most reporters who covered intelligence found the executive branch was the greatest source of leaks. Indeed, it was Casey's reckless boasting about Vitaly Yurchenko's defection from the USSR that spawned so many stories about his case, leading in part to Yurchenko's decision to redefect. "I always thought that the allegation that the Hill leaks was a lot of bullshit," Engelberg of the New York Times said. "If you go and look at the universe of secrets that the Hill is told about, and you look at the percentage that gets into print, which is a very low percentage, then I think you have to come to the conclusion that finding out intelligence secrets is not as simple as calling the head of the intelligence committees and stopping in for lunch." According to Engelberg, Casey and his aides often leaked material about Central America to bolster their case for whatever policy agenda they were pushing. Even when stories had already run on a particular case, such as the fact that Edward Lee Howard had begun working for the Soviets, the congressional committees were often close-lipped, Engelberg said. You'd bump into a member of the committee on the Hill the next day after a story ran, and he would say, "That was a really good story," Engelberg said. "What else can you tell me about it?" Engelberg would ask. "Well, I can't say anything, but if I were you, I would keep on going. I'd really keep on going." "Well, like what?" "Well, I would just look at the CIA if I were you." "Well, what else?" "I can't say." The majority of leaks came from the administration, Engelberg said. But I don't think there are too many to begin with, in the sense that someone sits down and says, "We're going to give the New York Times a piece of intelligence information." It's much more likely to be the case that on any given day you have a lot of reporters working hard. They'll hear something from someone who doesn't understand what it is, a piece of information that is only valuable and comprehensible to people who understand the business. You go around, you check it out. John McMahon, the former deputy director of Central Intelligence under Casey, said, "I witnessed more leaks coming out of the administration than out of Congress. I felt Congress was always fairly responsible." The only time in my experience when they really began to leak was when the Nicaragua program became so controversial, McMahon said. Literally, we would give a presentation to Congress, and before we could get downstairs, there was a press conference where it was being passed out what we were doing. Baker would later say that while he was director of public affairs, no U.S. reporter double-crossed or misquoted him. Often he found it was the CIA's own carelessness with information that led to the stories that CIA people so detested. Or the administration had leaked a story in order to push its own agenda. Baker's approach was to get out in front of the news, to know the reporters, to have some idea of what they were working on, and to be helpful when possible, Engelberg of the New York Times said. On several occasions, he said, "We would rather you thought hard before you printed that." It was a very different kind of relationship than with Casey's public affairs office. As a result, Engelberg said, there were stories where we treaded initially more softly than we otherwise would have because we were presented with what we considered to be reasonable objections. I would have to say that because of the way Webster dealt with the press, which is with a more open manner, we were more likely to give them the benefit of the doubt. Eventually, FBI Director William S. Sessions offered Baker the job of Assistant FBI Director for Criminal Investigations. For an FBI agent, this was like offering a Supreme Court judgeship to a lawyer. Baker left the CIA and rejoined the FBI in May 1989. Still not sure he could be comfortable with a CIA officer in the job, Webster replaced Baker with James W. Greenleaf, another FBI executive. Greenleaf had been assistant FBI director for training, which meant he headed the FBI's training center at Quantico, Virginia. Before that, he had headed the laboratory division. Like Baker, Greenleaf had a hard time adjusting to the special characteristics of the CIA. Each year, the agency holds a family day to commemorate the September 18th founding of the agency, a day when husbands, wives, and children can come to see where their parents or spouses work. Greenleaf got the idea that the agency could pass out CIA T-shirts, shorts, and caps. At Quantico, anyone could buy FBI shirts, shorts, or running outfits. But the Office of Security vetoed that idea. It was the same old problem that later led to Webster's rejection of the CIA Employee Association's plan to sell CIA mugs. What if the children of covert employees call attention to their parents' employment by wearing the garb? Unlike Baker, Greenleaf had no qualms about playing tennis with the boss. After Webster's first wife died and George Bush invited him to his Kennebunkport home, Greenleaf went along and played doubles with the then vice president, Webster, and a neighbor. Greenleaf, like Baker, came away impressed by the CIA. He felt the agency was one of the most misunderstood agencies in the government. When Greenleaf left in May 1990 to become the FBI's Associate Deputy Director for Administration, Webster felt comfortable enough with the CIA and its people to give the job to a CIA officer. He chose Joseph R. Detrani, who had headed the CIA's Office of Technical Service, the unit that makes the tools of the spy trade. Detrani was smart, witty, and direct. Before he left, Baker had recommended him as his replacement. They all seemed to have the same style, smooth in the good sense of the word, quick-witted, able to take a jab and keep rolling, Russell Broomer said of Webster's choices as public affairs directors. Detrani came into the job joking that public relations within the CIA is an oxymoron. After a year, he was saying that he had been wrong. The concept of public relations did not conflict with the CIA's mission. Today, the Office of Public Affairs has 28 employees, including secretaries. Besides two people who handle media inquiries and four others who clip papers and help in the media area, the staff includes members of the Publication Review Board, which reviews manuscripts, the director's speechwriters, and an academic coordinator. Some critics said that in emphasizing public relations, Webster was promoting himself at the expense of the agency. It was a short-sighted view. The truth is that one hand washed the other. That is like saying capitalists are mainly interested in making a profit, Engelberg of the New York Times observed. That's true, but in doing that they make the economy work better. I think Webster was terrified that something the agency does is going to end up on the front page of the New York Times or Washington Post. He would look like an idiot, the president would be angry at him, and his reputation would be ruined. That's true. So? The other side was that by being more open with the press, Webster was taking a risk. What if his policy backfired? What if the agency helped a reporter who wrote a story that damaged an operation? What if the agency turned against him and the president became displeased with him? It was so much easier and safer to sit back as in the old days and say no comment. But to Webster, this was the only way an intelligence agency could function effectively in a democracy. As a lawyer and former judge, Webster felt just as strongly about the need for an aggressive office of general counsel as he did about an active press office. He wanted a first-rate legal department, one whose advice would be actively sought by CIA executives. But to many, an office of general counsel seemed even more out of place at the CIA than an office of public affairs.